Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, and where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.
Welcome to the Ministry of Startups Founders Ramble, part two.
2.5.
And if you're wondering why it's 0.5, technically, we've done all this before. We are in the pub at the Commercial Tavern in the heart of Shoreditch, not far, a stone's throw from the Ministry of Startups and the big, wide, scary black smoke of the City of London. And last time we were doing this podcast, old Vinny forgot to press the on button on the microphone. But we have done this before, and this is the second attempt at it. I'm joined by Elliot from the Ministry of Startups. Hello, mate.
Hello. Nice to be here.
Ben couldn't make it. Is he presumably rescuing us from the ongoing threat of local thieves?
Yeah, I think he's having the day off.
If you're not sure what we're talking about, Ben, who runs Ministry of Startups, and he's almost entirely part of the furniture.
Yeah, last week he staked out a bin. He caught a thief by the leg who was stealing some cheese. He took some cheese. A couple of laptops and some cheese.
Whoa, hang on. I didn't know about this one. I knew about the dishwasher.
Yeah, no. Dishwasher and a bin went.
Right.
Police helped him steal the bin.
Yeah.
Thief came into the building over the fence, up the stairs, came down with a suitcase and a load of cheese. Ben caught him.
Suitcase and a load of cheese. So he's gone, I don't know what's in his suitcase, but I'm pretty hungry on the way.
I'll take some cheese.
I'll cover myself.
Yeah. Ben's caught him, said, what's that? He said, it's just some cheese.
And then he realised that he was a thief.
Is
this the guy that jumped out the window and Ben hung onto his legs?
Yes.
Right.
Over the fence, Ben got his leg through the fence.
Oh, I see. And then the police got called on that one. Yeah, we could do a separate podcast called What's Been Attempted to Be Stolen from the Ministry of Startups This Week and Was It a Chuckle Brothers Style Crime? But we'll probably never get anywhere with that. The idea of this podcast is to talk to founders and let them ramble. Let them tell us what it is that inspired them and what it is that they're doing and what it is they'd like to do and their hopes, their dreams, their wildest aspirations. And today I'm joined by Christoph from Somewhere Else. Christoph from somewhereelse.co and David from Stashby, one of the co-founders of Stashby. And we're going to have a little chat with you in the pub over a pint of beer over your lives, your hopes and dreams.
Brilliant.
And I'll start with you if I may, Christoph. What does Somewhere Else do, and why has it got such a cool name?
It's got a weird name because what we do is we're a creative agency that specializes in immersive technology. So immersive tech is anything that's like VR, augmented reality, and mixed reality. Hence the name Somewhere Else, because when you put on a headset, you are somewhere else.
Aha! And is this your company?
So we're three guys, and we launched it about a year ago.
And you've all presumably from quite a heavy tech background.
Not at all.
No?
No, not at all. None of us can do anything with our hands. We all come from a different types of agency background. So I did social media. Rami, one of my partners, was in high tech and experiential. And Julien was from digital background.
Okay. So so many questions. How did you all come together and come up with a whole virtual reality idea?
So I'm going to give you the 2 minutes version.
Okay.
One of Julien's friends, called Eric, is a 50-year-old dance choreographer, and he built his career on building new technology to dance. So, you know, like projection mapping and motion capture and things like that. And back in 2013, he had a project with Unit 9 here in London, big production house here. Yeah. And whilst he was working on Unit 9 for a dance project, they were among the first in the world to receive the Oculus Rift, the very first one, the DK one.
So what's it called? The Oculus Rift.
So yeah. That's the headset that belongs to Facebook. It's been bought by Facebook. And they released the first one in 2014. And so they had access to that. And so Julien and Eric started building a studio together, trying to come up with a few experiences for that. And I met Julien in a pub because I was just looking for people who work in digital in London. Yeah. And he had this in his backpack. And he showed me an experience called the Night Café. So Night Café is the painting by Van Gogh. And there was a guy who recreated the Night Café, the painting, but inside of the café in the style of Van Gogh.
Right.
And so I put on the headset.
In a virtual world.
In a virtual world. Yeah. So I put on the headset.
So this is already quite weird. You're in a pub, you've had a couple of beers, you've met a guy who's got an ocular, what's it?
Yeah.
The most forgettable name ever for me, sorry. And you said, all right, let's have a bash at that. And now you're in a virtual world looking at a painting. Meanwhile, I would be worried that he's stealing your wallet, but you obviously are a trusting man. And what did you see?
Well, so you basically, like, we're in a pub right now, okay? Yeah. So but imagine that this pub was painted by Van Gogh, right? Yeah. So the whole style, the brushes, everything would not feel real. It would feel like inside a painting.
Yeah.
So you feel like you're inside one of his paintings, for starters, and B, you can move around. So you're inhabiting one of the paintings. And if you like Van Gogh, the way, when you see the paintings, the way the brushes are, the way they're almost immersive. You know, you could imagine that if he was here today, it would probably be a work for Disney or Pixar. You know, he likes to draw you into his world.
Yeah.
And so suddenly I was in that world and I could move freely. And so it fucking blew my mind, and very quickly I quit the job I had before and we started working together with Julien.
Well, it had that much of an impact. You'd never seen anything like it in that respect. Because if you had the, I don't know, if you went to the Tate and you saw those heavy brush strokes of one of his paintings, would it have less of an impact on you than this virtual world?
Yeah, probably, because it's less about Van Gogh and more about I'm transported somewhere where I know rationally I'm not here. I know I'm in the pub. I can still kind of hear the pub. I can feel my chair. I can feel the table.
Yeah.
But when I turn my head, it turns my head in that world. And when I move forward with a controller or something, I'm actually moving forward. And so I was gobsmacked by the fact that, yes, it can trick your brain into believing that you are somewhere else.
That's very true. I did virtual reality sober, put the head masks on and thought, whatever, technology, geeks, losers, I won't be taken in by this. 2 minutes later, I was saying, kill the fucking Martians to everyone around me, some of which I've never met. How then, I should say, did you manage to say, okay, buddy, you seem to know a lot about this stuff, I'm enough so that I'm going to quit my job and start something. How did you take it into the next level? How did you set up a company?
It was a bit of a windy road, as I guess it always is. So first what I did is he already had a VR studio that he had just started with that guy, Eric, the dance choreographer. So I joined that studio first.
Right.
But we were very much doing experiences that were more on the artistic side. So very much like, you know, artistic project, dance related and things like that. And soon enough, we realized that VR had the potential to solve a big marketing problem, which is that with, you know, with social media, with the mobile web, our attention span is basically that of a goldfish.
Absolutely.
Like it's 8 seconds now, and a goldfish is 9 or something like that. Like it's actually shorter than a goldfish.
The fish are officially now outdoing us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And which means that when brands are spending millions on Facebook or TV ads or any content that is basically short-lived and printed in a frame, we have evolved as human beings, we're blind to that.
Yeah.
So our retention of commercial is dropping. But when I put you in VR, and it's not about I'm going to put a product in front of you in VR, it's I'm going to put a world that's basically brought to you by a brand. When I put you in a VR world and you reach that, what's called presence. So presence is not a marketing term. It's a like
psychological, perhaps.
Yeah, it's a psychological, but like, you know, scientifically based state of mind. And that's when you shift. It's when your brain believes that you're somewhere else. Yeah. And when it does that, it's not talking. If you're into the same area of your brain, it's not talking to the frontal lobe. It goes like straight to the reptilian brain. In other terms, you're not getting information. You're building memories.
Okay.
So
it's
really
bypassing the bullshit filter.
Exactly. But
it's going into sort of like, in the same way that you might remember something that was very significant to you that happened in the last few weeks. That's how you might recall this advertising experience.
It's exactly that. Which in turns, when you build memories, you build behaviors as well.
Yeah.
So there was, I mean, there's been a lot of studies, but there's one called that we call the Superman experiment. And there's this idea of, you know, you've played like a GTA, right, on PlayStation and stuff like that. A lot of people say violent video games, they create violent behaviors. A lot of studies say, no, actually, it's not the case. Violent video games allow you to, you know, get rid of all the violence within you. So no one knows. But those guys, they say, What about the opposite? Can we prime like generosity and you know, togetherness? And can we do anything like that? So they devised an experience where they took students, I think it was at Stanford University, and those students, they were going to put on a headset. In the headset, they were going to be flying over a city, and in the city, there would be a kid having a crisis of diabetes. Their mission would be to find the kid and to give him a shot of insulin, right? Half of the group of those students, they were in VR, they saw themselves as a passenger of a helicopter. Okay, and they were told, you're the doctors and you're in the helicopter, so you don't decide where you go, but you're in the helicopter. The other half, they were supermen, okay? So in VR, they saw their own arms with the, like, the blue, the lycra, and they could fly around by moving their arms.
So their arms are out in front of them, and they're feeling as if they're flying across
exactly.
The city.
Exactly. So they decided...
The guys are sat in a virtual helicopter, are they?
Yeah, exactly, virtual helicopter.
So not quite as intense.
So not quite as intense, but also not quite the same. One is a job, one is a superhero.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But the game is designed so that after 2 minutes, wherever they look, they're going to find the kid anyways. So it's not about how fast. So everyone finds the kid, everyone saves him, and then they sit down at the table with a researcher asking a lot of questions, you know, how do you feel, blah, blah, blah. But all the questions are bullshit. The only thing that matters in that interview is that the researcher on the table has a glass, almost like a glass full of pens, right? There's 15 pens in the glass. And after a few minutes in the interview, she, quote unquote, like inadvertently drops them on the floor. Okay? And what they did is they measured the time it would take the interviewee to start helping her and how much it would help her. And so the researcher, she doesn't pick a single pen for 6 seconds, right? 6 seconds of silence of nothing is very, very long. Okay? And then she's going to pick one pen a second. And the results are 100% of the people who had been Superman helped, but only 80% of the one who had been a doctor. The Superman, they started helping after 3 seconds. The doctors, it took them 6 seconds. The Superman, at the end of the day, they picked up 40% more pens than the other one. So, and you see the difference between the two experiences is almost nothing. You know, it's just like helicopter versus Superman, and the experience itself is 2 minutes long. And that happens about, you know, maybe an hour, a few hours later. So with a very short experience, you're really changing behavior
Let me check I've got the right conclusion of this. What you're saying is that what has happened to you, the manifestation of this false world inside your headset, albeit this very brief experience where you've taken on a different role, affects exactly how you behave immediately afterwards in the real world. So if you are, in this case, pretending to be a superhero, you're more likely to help someone in a very small tragedy. And if you're in a more of official role, like the helicopter guys, then they're less likely to help. So what can that tell us about advertising? Because here we are, you're running a company. You said a lot earlier about how that you were managing to, or it sounded as if you were trying to advertise through this forum. What does that mean? How does that apply itself to the, I hate this question, but it does always come about. So I might as well just do it. How do you monetize that? How do you draw people's cash out of them with this knowledge?
What's the point of advertising? How do you define advertising? What's the goal of advertising?
The goal of advertising, I suppose, well, for me, is to get more people to consume my product.
Yeah, and you're never going to force them to consume, right? Mm-hmm. The only thing you can do is A, make them aware, and B, make them want your product. So when you create desire, you create a behavior. And this whole idea of VR is, it seems that it can create behaviors a lot more powerfully and in a very short amount of time. Because it builds memories, because like the impact that it has on your brain, because it's immersive, it's super impactful. You know, it gets 100% of the audio and the visual input. So there's no looking around. There's no, hey, there's the reality between me and my screen. Therefore, I'm not really connected.
There's no quickly scrolling past the same bullshit special offer on Facebook that you've seen a load of times to the next small titillation and injection of dopamine from finding out it's your friend's birthday or whatever it might be. You're absolutely immersed to the point where it's also unhelpful, isn't it? Because I can surreptitiously advertise on an underground train or on Facebook. It's quite hard to stop someone in the street and say, hello, mate, would you mind sticking on this helmet and pretending to be a superhero?
That's all Oxfam's charity mugs are doing. They're out with an experience on their phone headset.
Is that what they do
they
now?
They walk straight up to you and they go, can you put this on?
Genuinely, do they?
Yeah, doesn't work.
No, it's there.
I've never seen the charity muggers, otherwise known as chuggers, or as I like to call them, chunts. do the maths. Anyway, what's that about then? Is it like a...
You see people looking and going, who's had that on before me? I'm not putting that on my head.
So, yeah, well, there you go. There is an attempt at it happening. It doesn't seem to be working. How can you will people into this immersive world? Or am I barking up the wrong tree after all?
No. You're absolutely right. It's a good question. Well, the point is now very, very few people have headsets at home. It's about 10 million headsets worldwide. And if you're playing a game at home, you don't want to be interrupted by a commercial, because it's like literally if someone took you out of the pub, like,
oh, yeah, be awful.
Took like this and then yeah. dropped
bad
you
enough when, during a movie, never mind when you're immersed in a false world.
I gave it a go actually, where it was, I think it's the bow and arrow game, and like I tried it out, it's completely immersive. You like stick it on, you get sucked into this world, which I was completely hooked to the game and I didn't want to take it off, and then you take it off and you're like, ah, crap, I'm back in this really dull real world. This sucks. But I was kind of thinking, I'm sure there must be quite a lot of opportunity to advertise to people in the immersive world of whatever game you're in or whatever world you're creating.
Product
like
placement.
Subtle product placement that you just place around the place, so you don't actually, you're like, I don't know, you've got to shoot through a goalpost when it has, you know, like some sort of football brand across the top of it, whatever it is.
Or you meet someone, maybe someone very sexy, and then they say, I just want to let you know that I'm wearing Chanel and that's why I'm so gorgeous. Insert your weird scenario here. I'm not sure what that says about me. So do you build these games? You don't. You said earlier that you're not a programmer, you're not a coder.
So I don't build them with my hands. So what we do is clients come see us with an idea. We go back to them, tell them most of the times why it's a bad idea, and talk until we come up with what is more like a strategy. And up until we talk about VR, it's like any agency, you know, what's the message, who's the audience, how are you going to talk to them, right. What do you want them to feel? And then once we reach that point, you're like, okay, the right stuff for you is, oh, a 360 video that's going to be on YouTube, or it's going to be a bigger activation in King's Cross with like, you know, 50 players at the same time. And once we do that...
50 players that might be just bored volunteers waiting for a train type thing.
Yeah.
That's another way of getting people interested in it. Yeah.
Exactly. We did exactly that for 3 Mobile. So it was in King's Cross, actually, and in Victoria Station in Manchester. I don't know my English train station too well. Yeah. But yeah, it's so then, you know, then it's normal. You write the creative, and then once we're all happy with the creative and the storyboard, like everything... Then either developers or animators or a combination of everyone are actually going to build it.
In the heart of London here, where we are, Shoreditch area, there's quite a lot of groovy advertising agencies that are probably quite willing to put their money into something new and exciting because that's the sort of area you work in. But if you're an insurance company in Glasgow, then you might not necessarily want to meet someone like you because you're like, no, we do Saga magazine and we do, you know, we hand out pamphlets in our banks, whatever it might be. So... how do you push people into this new world? Or do you find that they'll just come anyway? Maybe that's not your job.
No, I don't think they'll come anyway. I think VR is not an answer to every marketing problem. It's a new solution to all challenges. So when you work with the Champions League, for example, we did something for the UEFA in Cardiff, and it was the final. They had a fan zone.
Yeah.
So they had, you know, a physical location with a ton of people just walking around all day, drinking beers, waiting for the game. That was one side. On the other side, they have filmed a lot of the games in 360 degrees. And so they were like, you know, how do we get these people to see those films? And so what we did is we built a game for them where they could see, you know, I don't know, like the sixth goal of Barcelona against Paris or like the best moments of the Champions League. But also there was... interactive elements where you can like raise the cup and stuff like that. So we built an experience out of, you have a place, you have people, you already have content, you have a message.
Yeah.
and we're going to build something for that. So in that case, we didn't have to attract them.
Oh, that's a good answer. Very good. Okay. You are listening to Founders Ramble with me, Vinnie White, and Elliot for the Ministry of Startups. We're drinking a beer in a pub, and I've been talking there to Christoph, and we'll continue to, about somewhereelse.co. Somewhereelse.co is his website, and I've been doing a terrible job, and I feel awful, about ignoring poor old David from StashB.com. StashB is another company here in the nestled in the bosom of Ministry of Startups, in Ben's weird bosom. And what a lovely vision for us all.
And, so a couple of Coke cans and a burger wrapper in there as well.
Are you taking the piss out of Ben's terrible need to order in everything he's ever eaten? I've never seen him cook a sausage.
I've seen him cook a sausage.
Have you?
I've not seen him cook more. No. He made us a chili once.
How was that? And find out next week during Food Poisoning Monthly. Anyway, David from Stashby, I spoke very briefly to your co-founder and Anthony, who was very helpful and telling me the basics about what you do. Stashby, as in to stash away, B as in a buzzy thing, .com is, correct me if I'm wrong, the Airbnb of storage to a certain degree. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, yeah, simply we find people who have spare space and we match them together with people who are looking to store stuff. So quite a simple concept. But with lots of complications that make it all fun to try and launch.
It sounds great until you actually have to go and set up the company and then stumbling blocks appear as they always do. How long has it been going and how's it going?
Yeah, no, it's been going for about a year and it's been going really, really well. Me and Anthony met on something called Escape the City.
You weren't in a pub and putting on a virtual headset?
No, unfortunately not.
You're so not cool.
And yeah, we basically, both of us had like a really similar concept, both about storage problems. Mine was basically I had a bike in my living room and I basically kept tripping over it and it was really pissing me off. And I was like, I really need to put it somewhere. And in the end, I had nowhere. I sort of live in a top floor flat in the center of London, had nowhere to put it. So I ended up building a bike shed in my front garden at like quite a lot of expense. And I was like, this is crap. Like, there must be a better way of doing it.
Yeah.
And Anthony had a sort of similar-ish experience where he ended up breaking up with his girlfriend and had to move out all of a sudden and had nowhere to put all of his crap.
I don't know what that's like. I can't relate to that. And I'm sure everyone listening is in a perfect relationship and have never had any bumps or faults. So he had a sort of similar-ish experience on a need for storage.
Yeah, and we were just both like, basically both of us historically had used storage companies and were like, this is such a crap experience, you know, going to out-of-town warehouses with people who really aren't that fun to deal with.
Yeah.
And then there must be a better way of doing it. And not only that, but like, you know, people around us have loads of space. Surely there must be a way of being able to utilise that. And so, yeah, about a year ago, we basically launched our first version of the product. So it was just a really simple MVP website. So
MVP?
Like minimum viable product.
Okay.
I
thought it was something to do with a panty line. What's that? Visible panty line. VPL. This will get cut out.
Save that for the other podcast.
So that's the sexist section, which we will cut out. Anyway, go on.
So we sort of chucked it out there in the world and weirdly, like just through like advertising through a bit of Facebook stuff and, you know, sticking it around all over the place to find out whether anyone would be interested, we sort of picked up some people who said, yeah, I'd like to make some money out of my spare space, and then found some really crazy people who were like, hell yeah, I'd like to store my stuff in someone else's space. So like the real first version of it was, we found this, you know, lady who lived in North London who was like, yeah, I've got a box of stuff. I'm going to go away for a couple of months. I'd love you to store that stuff for me somewhere. And she was like, can you do pick up and drop off? And we were like, you know, we could give it a go. So I sort of like hopped in a car.
I love that. Yeah. It looks like we do now.
Yeah. Sure. Why not?
Yeah. How long have you been doing this? 10 years. It's our thing. Yeah.
So we like hopped in a car, drove all the way over to North London, picked up this box, one box, drove it all the way to South London and put it in someone's garage. And we were like, wow, someone's paid us money to pick up a box and drop
and at
it off
this point,
on the
my website. This is all off Facebook and various other social media.
Yeah, there was like a one, a landing page kind of website, very basic. But nothing really. She paid us £5 per month to store the box. We were like, cool. Well, obviously, there are people out there who need to store stuff, and there are other people out there who have spare space.
How much did you pay the person whose space it was?
Yeah, well, like really early days, we were like, well, we'll pay them. We'll pay. We'll take a 20% fee, and they'll take 80% of that.
Okay.
So with this one box, this
so you're
experiment,
making £1 a month.
We were making
between
a pound a month,
guys.
Exactly.
This sounds like it's going to go real quick.
We were like, wow, this. Obviously, there are people out there who want to do this, but how the hell could we actually make any cash out of it?
Yeah.
And quite quickly, we realized that maybe people who just want to store one box wasn't a viable way to sort of tackle this as a business.
Yeah.
And so over time, we realized that actually, like, larger spaces were really where it was, people who had the space were going to make decent money out of it, and the people who are looking to store stuff, could actually get a discount compared to self-storage.
Right. Yeah.
So we started going after sort of more like garages, spare rooms, large basements, outhouses, that kind of stuff. Yeah. And what we realized is actually there are a lot of people out there who have a huge requirement to store stuff. And there are a lot of people out there who do have spare space. And since then, we've been matching people together. And basically, we do other things to make it more convenient for people. So we like provide insurance, and we do transport as well. So we can do pick up and drop off. Although I say probably the majority of people do that themselves.
Do it themselves to their chosen storage address. So let's say Mrs. Miggins wants to store a load of power tools, right? Mm. Her husband recently died. She might well use them one day, but frankly, I don't know why I'm painting such a dark picture. But
they could have been Mrs. Miggins' power tools.
Yeah, exactly. This is the new world. Mrs. Miggins has got some power tools. She's had a small accident, and therefore she can't use them for the next year. She knows that. And so Mrs. Miggins wants to get her power tools and put them in Frank's house. Frank lives a few roads away. Obviously, you've done the introduction of these two people and the concepts of the space, and they've both agreed to it. Perhaps the necessary insurance has been done. So is now Mrs. Miggins walking around to Frank's house with a box?
Not normally with just one box, but with many, many boxes.
Many boxes, yeah.
But yeah, essentially, like, she'll probably stick them in the back of her car.
And does she meet this guy? Does she meet the guy that's going to provide the storage?
Yeah. So we always recommend, we do a bunch of stuff to make it all nice, safe and secure. So we, like, identity check everyone who uses the service. We provide storage agreements and stuff like that. But we always recommend they go round, meet each other first, see the space, make sure they're happy. And then, they'll go around and move their stuff in.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, Mrs. Miggins has a rapid recovery and desperately needs a drill. Only 3 months afterwards, who would have thunk it? She thought she wasn't going to see those things for a long time. She needs to get around to Frank's house. Is she going to call Frank or is she going to call you?
Definitely going to call Frank, yeah. Basically, yeah. Like, this is like, we match people together, but we want people to communicate with each other. They live in the local community. That's part of, like, the reason why they want to do this with each other is because, it's nice and local. So we recommend, speaking to each other and arranging to pick up stuff and drop off stuff. And when you want to access, making sure you text them or give them a call.
Got it. Quite often with startups, and I think a lot of people that work at Ministry of Startups that are listening to this or starting something up themselves or have a vague entrepreneurial spirit will relate to this. You start something like you did driving across London. You make a pound, whoopee-doo, and you think, hang on, we're onto something here. You have a like-minded business partner that, maybe is better at the things you're not good at and vice versa. But then the next bit is the scary bit of actually putting some time, quite often a hell of a lot of time, and sometimes some money into it. And then that's when people get cold feet. How do you surf through that difficult bit?
Yeah, that's really hard. I mean, they always talk about the startup roller coaster and the insane journey that it can be and the peaks and troughs you can get with it as well. I think, if you every day you see like new things happen with your idea, and over time you can look back, you can forget not to look back and see what you were doing last month. Mm. And actually, if you have on a piece of paper what you accomplished last month, and you have on a piece of paper what you accomplished this month, and you start to see the difference between those, you can see sort of how much you're moving forward.
Do you relate to this at all on this one, Christoph?
On the roller coaster side of things?
Yeah, the roller coaster, the fact that you know, it's really easy to come up with an idea. It's quite easy to start it. It's the next bit when you have to invest time and money and it all gets a bit scary. Did you go through that stage?
Yeah, of course. I think, there's a lot of doubts and, you know, short nights where you're like, what the fuck am I doing? Well, why don't I go back to a salary paid job where I can fuck off at 6 p.m. and plan my holidays.
It might have been boring, but boring was quite nice. Yeah.
So you have some of that. There's also a lot. I don't know what you think, but there's also the kind of like, yeah, we're going to do this and we're ready in a month. And what you don't know, and what you don't know that you don't know is immense. Like, it never goes according to plan. If you're not in a normal job, you know, there are processes and stuff. You kind of know more or less what you'd be doing in 3-6 months. Right now, it's a bit like, you know, kind of one step at a time. It's more like, you know, like 2 steps forward, 1 back. But hopefully, you moved forward a little bit more than the last time you moved back.
So you almost have to plan for that, right? You almost have to say every week at a certain time. And it's beneficial if you're in a bigger company because you probably have a meeting. I can actually say we've done this in the last month. Obviously, we need to do this. But we did this, and well done. And if there's a bit of money in the budget, let's have a beer on a Friday and celebrate it. Like, you actually have to instigate and plan for the celebration and the looking back and that feeling of achievement. In other words, you really genuinely do have to pat yourself on the back every now and then.
All the time. We call it, like, full summits. Like, you always get to these kind of, like, you always got this goal here, and you get to it, and you're like, shit, that was amazing, we got there. And you, like, have this high-five moment, and you go out and have a pint, and then tomorrow you wake up, and you're like, yeah, we've got to climb the next peak.
Yeah.
And then the next peak. And then you're like, you're always doing that.
So, to reverse that, if you want your business to fail, don't celebrate. Only ever look at the shit that's coming down the tunnel and keep ploughing on and feeling quite miserable about it. That's the sort of antithesis of the wrong advice, isn't it? So, yeah, no, that's really good advice. I like that.
I think it's a very good point, because we are, like in our company, like, the way it works is slightly different. So it's not so much financial objective as we work to sign that client, and most times you don't, and then sometimes you do. And when you do, you should absolutely go out and celebrate. But immediately we're like, oh, fuck, we've signed now. Are we actually going to be able to deliver? So the anxiety of delivery takes over the fear of losing.
It.
And you're absolutely right in a way, and that's what I tell my partners all the time. It's like, guys, you know, we just won the Champions League. The fucking Champions League. We've been football fans for 25 years. We just have to party.
Yeah.
Yeah, but how are we going to make a margin? And have you seen the deadline? No, we have to get 4 points. It's really rare to be able to kind of stop and look back. And quite often it happens outside of the company. So you talk to a guy and you talk about your job and you're like, it was a tough month. And he's like, mate, You realize you just work for the Champions League and you're doing VR. And it's your own company as well. It's fucking cool. I go to the office day in, day out in my suit and I fucking hate it.
I give my left testicle to be you. Would you? Great.
Yeah, exactly. And then for a few minutes you're like, okay, yeah, maybe it's actually worth it. But it's very, very short, you know, short burst of times. You're never gonna, or if you do walk around being, hey, I'm an entrepreneur, look at me, then fuck you, you know, it's always it. But I think the very nature...
You don't see that a lot, though, do you? I don't see anyone that's not humble in the Ministry of Startups. Perhaps I'm quite naive to it, but
if you go to WeWork, it's going to be...
Yeah, I think Ministry of Startups is a filter. They don't get through.
Really?
Yes.
So if you go to WeWork, is it a bit more swanky pants?
Well,
is it?
I think if they did, Ben would pick them up and drop them off at the door.
Well, so if you're listening and you fancy a bit of bullshit, Ministry of Startups might not be the place for you. But that's, speaking of bullshit, right? So I think anyone that starts a company, whether it be Stashby or somewhere else, well, that's a really weird sentence. Somewhere else is the name of your company. I could say Stashby or somewhere else. Or somewhere else. Anyway, you get the idea. No matter what you're starting, you always have to go to a certain level of, I can do that. And inside, you're probably like, Jesus, can I? And then you get called on your bullshit, right? So whether it be delivering your first giant storage space or designing a virtual world for a client, you're always going to get called on that bullshit. Then you've got to deliver. And that's also another time where people go, oh, hang on a minute, I didn't really plan for this. So how do you deal with that?
This is like, I've been just talking about this with Anthony, which is like, you know, when you're born, you don't know how to walk. Mm. And, you know, when you're a teenager, you don't know how to write a dissertation. When you've written, when you start a business, you have no idea how to start a business. Yeah. And like so many people come up to me, like when they're, you know, asking, oh, so how did you do it? You know, how did you register a business? How did you do all these steps of things? And you're like, you know, you can explain it to people, but you're like, until you do it, you have no idea. Yeah. Have no idea how to do it. And like, you know, and you have to get comfortable with the idea that you have, tomorrow you're going to hit a problem that you've never dealt with before, and you're going to have to work out how to fix it. And that's fine. You just have to get comfortable knowing.
We've suddenly gone away from the podcast and my personal life. It's amazing that you said that about registering a business. Two nights ago, I was up all night worrying about it. I did it yesterday. It was 12 quid and took half an hour. It really isn't that hard. So quite often, the barrier is bigger than the actual problem and objective itself.
Loads of people put these kind of like false barriers. Well, they're like, oh, I haven't registered a bank account, so I can't set up a business. We didn't have a registered bank account.
Yeah.
We didn't have anything when we started, and we were still.
When you got your 5 quid, it was probably cash, was it?
Yeah.
No, if you're listening in Land Revenue, it was only 5 quid. Get over it. All right. Get yourself down to the City of London, where they are pulling crazy things over your eyes.
Are you still storing that box for her?
No. She that one was. I wish we were. No, I mean, like, she basically she called us 2 weeks later and was like, "Oh yeah, I've decided I'm not going to stay in Italy. I'm coming back. Can I have my box back?" And at that point, we were like, "Oh well, we hadn't really envisaged incorporating the transport of your box back to North London again." And she was like, "Oh, what the hell? I'm not paying extra for this." So we actually took this box. We have a picture of it, and we got an Uber and basically shipped this box all the way back across London in an Uber. And this guy took a picture of it, and it just happened to be like the most fancy Mercedes, you know, Uber with this little box sitting on the back seat driving across London. And so, like, not only did we go and pick it up and it cost, you know, like 15 quid's worth of fuel, did we pay for an Uber, which was another 25 quid to get it back over, of which we only made £1 on the box. But, you know, if we hadn't done all of that, like, how the hell would you ever know that you couldn't structure a business?
Yeah. It just sort of epitomises your point from before, doesn't it? Oh, what happens if someone wants to get it back? Well, then we'll give it back, we'll lose some money, and we'll write a policy where there's a fee, I should imagine, for cutting short on your contract or wherever it might be. Learn as you go along. Have you got a lot more learning to do?
Yeah. I love it. I mean, that's what actually like gets me up in the morning. Like, to be honest with you, I found like I got to a point with a job before where you're paid a wage, where you're like 9 to 5, where you're not, you stop learning as much as you could be.
Yeah.
And then with this, you have no idea what's going to hit you tomorrow. That's what's exciting and gets me out of bed.
That's it. Like, you give away financial security to wake up every morning confronted with new problems and ending up working a lot more. It's, you know, it sounds a bit counterintuitive, but there must be a psychological catch in there. And I think the catch is it's painful, but it's fun. Like I never mind waking up in the morning, even though I'm stressed and everything. The very fact that every day is different, I think plays.
Well, the success of your business is always going to have more of an effect on your life when it's at least partially your actual business, not, you know, Merrill Lynch. Because really, when you go to bed after working for a large company, particularly a bank, you're like, do I really care if it lost 10 billion overnight? Would it make any difference to me? And that's just looking at the finance. Also, there's the moral objective of, I don't even believe in what this bank stands for. So you can't possibly be that tied to it. Whereas your company, you are it. Like, you're not just tied to it. You are it.
It's the question is, if you are doing the same job, the exact same job, but not for Stage B, for someone else. You know, like, on a minute-by-minute basis, it's the same. So you don't derive necessarily pride, I guess. You don't necessarily derive pride or pleasure from the actual, oh, that was a good email. I had fun typing it with my fingers. It's more like I this is a tiny, tiny brick I'm adding to the house that I'm building for myself, kind of. So I think there's a big, like, psychological construct in your head that you're in a journey, either with yourself or with partners, and it's a very cheesy term, but I think the term adventure really, really applies, you know.
Yeah.
It goes you back to almost like a childhood-like kind of mindset. We're like, ah, yeah, let's do it. And the enemies and the problems and the challenges, but it's, yeah.
I hope that we don't sound arrogant. I hope that we don't sound like the people that don't run their own business, that aren't entrepreneurial, that there's anything wrong with that. Or correct me if I'm wrong, I don't feel that it's for everyone. I think that you have to be a certain character. And I think that a lot of people that work in the corporate world, albeit that they might not be as happy as they could be, they've got kids, responsibilities, and, you know, they've got a tough life. And for them, it does work. So I hope, you don't think we sound a little bit anti the man, do we? Actually, why do you care? Maybe that's, you're all right with that.
No, I think we do, and there's clearly a little bit of like preaching our choir. The same way, if you were to, I mean, we were all on the other side, if you're not on the barrier, and I was perfectly happy. You know, I had a better salary, and I could, you know, I had more money for starters. I could plan holidays. I could go to restaurants. I could see my friends more during the week. There's a lot of things that are very good about life that I miss,
yeah.
And it's more. I guess it's more of a trade-off. And absolutely, if I had, I don't have kids, I don't have a mortgage, I don't have any of that. So my financial insecurity is only on my shoulders and not on anyone else's. So if I fail, I fail for myself. And also, I'm lucky enough that if I do fail, I still have my parents around and I'm not going to end up in the street. So there's a lot of like things like, you know, I don't have family responsibility. I have people to take care of me if it fails. Like, it's a lot easier for me than it would be for someone else maybe to do something like that.
Yeah.
I'd say like the same way. I mean, like I earn four times less than I did 3 years ago. You know, I mean like that. But the pleasure I derive from what I do is so much more than what I did previously. And also not only that, but you get trapped. This is this whole full sense of security of a job. And you know, your salary is so important to you. Like I derive far more happiness from what I do now and the money I earn now than I did with my previous job.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, maybe that's all down to the individual, but I do think there's a lot of perceived like risk involved in this, and then the actual risk is actually not that big. So, I mean, actually, I would reverse it on its head, and I'd say the risk of not doing it is greater than the risk of doing it. Because
particularly if you're the type that might regret it later in life.
Yeah.
And only 10, like if you ask 100 people on their deathbed what they regret, it is the things they didn't do, not the things they did. Well, the occasional marriage here and there. But you know what I mean? So, yeah.
Are we back on Vinny's personal story podcast?
No, everything's fine. If you're listening, darling, I love you dearly. So, no, it's all good. All right, so just to conclude then, I have been talking with... I've had a beer as well, and it's gone to my head in the sun. And it was on Ministry of Startups. Last time we did this podcast, I forgot to turn the microphones on, and that meant that I got a free beer last time, and I've now had another one. So I'm just thinking about doing a lot of these without the microphones on, seeing how many pints I can get out of it.
Do you want me to tell Ben the memory cards were corrupted?
Yeah, corrupt the memory cards.
Memory cards.
And
drop yours in.
That's it. And that's why I had to get another pint. Yeah, I have been speaking to Christoph from somewhereelse.co, designing... How would you synopsize what you do?
VR and augmented reality experiences for brands.
There we go. Here's a whole new world of advertising, somewhereelse.co, for more information. And David from stashb.com, one of the business partners with Anthony, who have come together to start up a solution for storage for everybody in and around the whole of the UK?
Yep.
Yeah. So if you've got a spare garage and you want something parked in it that's not a car, then you can work on that for a slogan. then go to stashb.com and they'll help you out. And as we wrap up here at the pub, sad thing though it is, have you got anything that you'd like to add to anything that we've concluded?
Not that comes to mind, Pete.
No. The only thing I would say is the Ministry of Startups is a pretty awesome place to work. Definitely. If anyone's looking for workspace and good people to hang out with, then come and work at Ministry of Startups.
How do you describe it to your friends?
That's a good question.
And now filter that and do it more for radio.
It's like it's a great community of fun people. Plus, we have an axe throwing. How do you describe that?
It's an axe throwing range at the back.
There you go. I mean, like, where can you work that has an axe throwing range?
I haven't seen that.
Yeah. Since we're on the subject, I wonder if I could use this as a way to get things done. Can someone provide a new axe or sharpen the current axe?
Yeah, it definitely needs to be a bit sharper, yeah. I think. Or maybe we're just crap at throwing the axe, I'm not sure.
I guess we want to thank these two as well for being part of the community.
Yes,
I mean, and they're both doing amazing things. I saw the need for what Stashby are doing. I liked it the first time you both told me about it. You know, I tried to store some stuff in Big Yellow self-storage and it was £90 for a telephone box. You know, I had £1,000 worth of furniture storing it for a year. I might as well have sold my furniture. There was no point. And somewhere else very kindly done a VR evening for us in there. And I'd played with the Oculus Rift before and it was interesting, but not best thing ever. Watched people playing it. I had a go on the archery game. Was interesting. You had a gnome experience. Was that something you were part of building, or was that someone else?
That was built by John Favreau.
Because the moment for me that I thought VR was there and VR was, you know, this is amazing, is you had someone from the office on the gnome experience, and you're in a, as I remember it, you're in a forest, you're looking up at this tree, you're wondering what you've got to do, and there's a gnome on the ground. He's only a couple of inches high. And so whoever's got this headset on has got down on all fours, and then they're flat on the floor, and they're nose to nose with this gnome. And the fact that this VR program has got someone, you know, to lie on the floor face first in a room full of people, so they can be nose to nose with the gnome, I couldn't believe it.
Well, that gave you enormous happiness.
Gave me enormous happiness. You're looking at the moment. I've seen people spinning. I've seen them waving their arms around. You know, to see someone, you know, get down on all fours and then drop to the floor so they can stare at the gnome. Brilliant.
How would you describe it then?
When I describe it, I say WeWork meets Trainspotting.
WeWork's a well-known brand, slightly higher-end startup house, and Trainspotting is a film that depicts drug-taking culture.
Yeah, there's no drugs.
No, there's no drugs.
No drugs.
Oh, you mean the grittiness, perhaps?
Yeah, I mean the grittiness, and it's exactly about the grittiness. It's also an excuse when clients want to come and all the rooms are taken. But I say that in a nice way, because what I mean is no one is here to show off. No one is here for the corner office.
Yeah.
There's no, hey, look, we have free beers at WeWork type thingy. It's not like you don't have to book a slot and pay for it for the meeting room if you want. If yeah. David's in there, and maybe he might move because he doesn't need it, or vice versa. So everyone in there is just kind of working into the ground and doing their stuff, you know. There's, because now being in a startup is all this. It's the hero of today is the startup guy, you know.
Like, yeah.
He could have been the lawyer before, could have been the doctor. Then he was the marketing guy. Then he was the finance guys. You know, like no, now
that's
now,
so true. Yeah, that really
now,
is
now
true.
The pop culture, like, Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg. Like those are the heroes of today. So everyone wants to be a hero, and there's.
And there's nothing like the Ministry of Staff to ground you.
Ground you. I think there is such a thing as a startup bitch, where the fact of belonging to that world is more important than what you actually do. And I've met a lot of people who are like this. It's all like mythology of, you know, I'm meeting VCs and etc. It's, you know, it has become a world with its codes and stuff. And sometimes it is completely ridiculous from the outside. And what I really like at Ministry of Startup is there's nothing like that.
Yeah.
It's just like dudes sitting down with a laptop trying their best to get something off the ground. And that's why it's transporting in a way, I guess.
It's probably worth mentioning as well, if you haven't been to the Ministry of Startups, that all the Ministry of Startups buildings will be knocked down at some time within the next 4 or so years. So
not because of anything we've done.
Yeah, not because
without a warning, so you better get successful quickly.
We sound the alarm. You've got to get your monitors out, your laptops out. You've
yeah,
got like 45 minutes.
Perfect. So that's the, like why they've got this sort of rundown feeling, and none of the elevators work. But I love them. It keeps you fit going up all those stairs.
Yeah.
Right, lads. If we stay in this pub anymore, I'll have another beer, and that will mean no work, no entrepreneurialism, and company failures everywhere. It's up to us to keep this ball in the air. Thank you for joining me, Christoph from somewhereelse.co and David from stashby.com and Elliot from the Ministry of Startups. My name is Vinny White.
I've been hosting this podcast, and these chaps have been downright gorgeous. Good night.
Founders Ramble. Stories from entrepreneurs, how they started, why they started, and where they're going next. Brought to you by the Ministry of Startups.